Okay, good morning. So last week we started the topic of simulation, and the first order of business to say what a simulation was, and at a very high level it's a model of a real life system, and the purpose of the model is to study a system and observe system behavior without actually having to build the system. And so with that we can do performance analysis, and we can also test alternative solutions, or indeed alternative sort of usage models. So the idea of a simulation model is that its output is a representation of the behavior of a system. And we're going to be looking at sort of one very specific type of representation. And this is what's called a discrete event simulation. And here, at the core of our model, is the idea of an event, which represents state, which changes sort of drastically at unpredictable times, or perhaps abruptly would be a better word. Okay. So, if we think about sort of the overall, the behavior of the system is modeled by its state, then the events can be used to reproduce the state. Okay. Within discrete event simulation models, we are going to use what's called an event advance model, and that means that when we're sort of determining sort of how behavior evolves, we move from event occurrence to event occurrence to event occurrence. And this is contrasted with a time advance, where you would move from one periodic time instance to the next, to the next, to the next, and examine whether events were or were not occurring at those moments in time. Okay, so the key element, we then observed that the key elements of our model were the event list. And so event lists would be ordered according to the time of occurrence of these events. And we observed that one handy way to keep track of that in a programming environment was the linked list. We then needed event logic to determine basically what happens in the system when an event occurs. So you pull the first most the event due to occur off your event list, you examine it, does it spawn other event occurrences, and of course what sort of states, what sort of state do you have to track down to make that, or to keep track of to make that determination. And we didn't say a lot about that, but again, it's pretty obvious that you need it. And finally, we need some sort of time advance mechanism. So typically, in the types of simulations that we're interested in, time is important. But it's also unpredictable or random. So we need to, first of all, just track it, and we can use clocks to track our time. But then we need some mechanism for, again, representing random time, and specifically random according to some specific probability distribution. So we wrapped up last Friday's lecture with a discussion of how you can generate random variates. So the first thing to do would be to generate what we would call random numbers, which are variates with a distribution which is uniform between 0 and 1. And we call it pseudo-random, again, because we have some algorithm for producing this, so it has if we don't know the algorithm, then it, and just look at the observations, then it looks random, but there is some actual method to generate these numbers. And therefore, the exact sequences can be reproduced. Okay, I noted that generally, what you guys will be doing would not be to generate them yourselves necessarily, but again, you can call the Java random number class. Okay, so once you have your single distribution, you can leverage that to produce variates which look like they're being drawn from other distributions. The first technique we discussed to do that was the inverse transform technique. And in order to apply this technique, you're going to need a cumulative distribution, density function, and that's going to have to be invertible, since that's what the technique does. So we looked at a few examples where we used that. Then we also looked at other popular distributions and how which don't necessarily have this invertible CDF or not in any easy form. And we saw how they could be constructed starting with your uniform 0-1 distribution. And finally, we looked at empirical distributions. So you have a set of data, and from that you want to produce variates that look like they're distributed in the same way as that data. So we use the data itself to try and generate a CDF. We do that. And then once we have that CDF, we can use our inverse transform technique. Okay, so that's what we did last time. So now we're going to assume that we've built our model, and what we want to do now is to analyze the output from our model. Okay. The primary reference for this material is Harry Parros. And again, if you want to go into significantly greater detail, then Jerry Banks is a good reference. Okay. So, yeah, as we said before, the purpose of our doing these simulations, and therefore the purpose of our output analysis, is either to consider the performance of a single system or to compare the performance of two or more alternative systems. For the purposes of this lecture, we're going to confine ourselves to looking at the performance of single systems. Okay. And so what we've said so far is that if we have a model, then the model can be used to generate possible representative behavior of the system. Okay. And so if we have a run, if we run the model, then you're going to get one outcome out of possibly an infinite number that would be possible for this system. So the question then is, what does this one output tell us about the system? Okay, and we'll see the answer to that is one output isn't actually going to tell us enough at all, usually. Okay. So, if we don't use one output, potentially we'll use a number of outputs. And what questions can we ask, or what can we estimate from a number of outputs? And typically we want to, we will estimate some sort of system statistical parameter. Okay. So we might estimate the mean or the standard deviation of some variable within a system. We might try and estimate the something about the probability distribution of the variables within the system. Okay. So we'll start out looking primarily at estimation of averages, sort of the mean value of some random variable within the system, and then we'll say a few words about how the others work, you know, because it's once you've done one, it's similar for the others. Okay. So what we produce when we run a simulation is, again, the sample behavior. And within that, we can observe various quantities. And all of those quantities tend to be random variables within the system. So, moving away from events now and towards sort of what we're interested in the system, we will be again interested in variables when we run the system. We will be generating sample values for these variables we're interested in. And so before we start that, we are going to classify our variables as either exogenous or endogenous. And your exogenous variables are the ones that are independent of other variables over the course of the run. Typically, these are either the input values to the system, or possibly sort of internal to the system model. And so if you think about a very simple example, which you should have seen, a queue. So we can think of our queue as being this state model where you have arrivals and departures. And what we've observed already is that what is variable in the system is time, then. Okay, first and foremost. So a good example of an exogenous variable that's sort of independent of the other variables in the system would be the inter-arrival time. So the arrivals are sort of the input to the system, and there's no way to influence the time between arrivals. Similarly, we have, at least in the cases we're looking at, service time. There's no way to influence the amount of time that is going to service. Okay, so those are variables that you're going to have to actually generate values for. Your second class of variables, which is more interesting from the output perspective, is the endogenous variables. These are affected by other variables over the course of the simulation run. And again, these could just be internal, something that you need to calculate to get to the point you want to go. Or they could be output variables, and typically these might be the ones that you want to observe and do calculations on. So for a queue, again, variables that we might want to observe or do calculations on would include mean waiting times in a queue, or the number of jobs in a queue, so the size of the queue. Okay. So they're not something that you have control over. What we want to do is observe those variables and draw conclusions about those variables. Well, so the first step is that we need to consider how to collect this data. And again, this is going to most likely be something that you build into your simulation logic. So for any run of a simulation, at the very least, what we're going to generate is a sequence of time-stamped events. Okay. And we know that from those events, you can reconstruct everything that you consider interesting about the system. Now, one thing that is possible is to write this data into a file and then sort of do the analysis on the data sort of after the fact. You can also consider incorporating data structures into your model that will store relevant data. Okay. And so either, again, this will be some big list of data that you need, or possibly, in some cases, just increment counters that increment according to something about the system time. Okay, so if we look at an example, say, waiting times, then each arrival-departure pair can be held with the time between the arrival and departure, and so that'll give that the waiting time. Or possibly you could just keep a running tally of the time between arrivals and departures. Okay, average that over the total time. So again, if we return to our example of a simple queue, then in order to characterize the behavior of the queue, well, we need to know the arrival process and the service process. And so those are our exogenous variables that we're going to model. And then we also might need to know the service discipline, since there will be differences between first in, first out, and, say, a last in, first out. For the moment, we'll start by considering first in, first out. And so we can run our simulation for some fixed time period, and over that time period, depending on, again, our exogenous variables, we're going to observe a number of arrivals and departures. So again, this produces a single observation of the system. So for this single observation, what data can we gather? Okay. So just to name the two quantities that we were already mentioned, for this single observation, we can gather the average waiting time, and we can gather the average queue length. Okay. So, to calculate the average waiting time, we just have to, we have, again, n arrivals within our time frame, and we just have to calculate how long each of those arrivals took, or how long it took for each of those arrivals to get service. Okay. And so you can see that your first arrival is also going to be the first departure. Your second arrival will then be the second, correspond to the second departure, your third arrival to the third departure, your fourth arrival, which to the fourth departure. And again, you should be able to convince yourself that you can calculate all of these times just by knowing the sequence of arrivals and departures. Okay. So, as long as we track arrival times and departure times, either after the fact or, if you're clever, sort of as you go along, you should be able to calculate this waiting time. So, you can calculate it for each individual job and then take the average over all of the jobs. Okay. So now, another quantity that we might wish to consider is the average queue length. And so this has to be an average over time, and sort of how, you know, what's the queue length at any given time. And so to calculate this, well, we can observe that the queue length is only changing, again, according to these arrival and departure events. So if something arrives, the queue length goes up by one. If it departs, the queue length drops by one. Okay. And so if we track the time between these events, we can calculate the duration that the queue spends in any given state. Okay. And so, again, you can do this by sort of analyzing everything afterwards, or you can keep a running tally as you go along, so you'd need some array or something of Q lengths, and you can calculate the beginning and end point of being in that and keep a running tally. Okay. So, again, just to emphasize, we're still taking only a single sample value. So we've observed one possible behavior of the system and taken our average value over that one possible behavior in the system. Okay. Again, there are other questions we can ask. We can ask about percentile values. And so here, the question would be something on the order of, what is the maximum waiting time experienced by 95% of our arrivals? Okay. So, to answer a question like that, well, you're going to have to keep track of all of the waiting times for each arrival, and roughly what you'll do is then order them and look at sort of the maximum value that 95% of them experience. Okay, so if you have 100 observations, just to make it easy, if we have them in order of increasing waiting time, then we look at the 95th one, and that gives us our maximum waiting
time. Is that 100 arrivals, or is it 100 initial sets that
No, right now it's arrivals. We're looking at one trace sample behavior. So for the moment, we're looking at one sample behavior. Okay. And so as you are getting at there, if we look at a different sample behavior, we're going to get a different number there. Potentially, most likely. Okay. Okay, so just almost to wrap that up. If we want to extract the behavior from the system, we have to examine our arrival or our event sequences, and potentially, the system model will influence exactly the interpretation of those event sequences. For instance, if you have last in, first out versus first in, first out, obviously the waiting times are going to differ. Here you only have one arrival. But in last in, first out system, you're going to calculate the you're going to serve the last thing to occur first. That's probably okay. Well, I'm not convinced this slide is exactly correct, because you probably begin serving this one, serving the arrives at T3 first. Then you'd probably serve arrives at T5 when that was done, so the part's T7, so apologies, there probably is a mistake, but the point of this is just that it is going to differ depending on what your system model is, so you just have to be careful about, more careful than I've been, about observing the different variables. If we want to ask then about queue length, well, we're going to have to keep track of, again, different quantities within the system, so we can generate So we can either sort of track the arrival-departure pairs to generate queue lengths and then add them together, or again, we can keep a running tally as we go along. So the sort of endpoint of that story is just that you want to consider carefully how you're going to gather out your data as you're designing your system. And again, you can incorporate variables into your system or just dump the data to the file and process it after the fact. Okay, and so that just summarizes your options. You can export your file, you can keep arrays or linked lists, and of course you have to then make sure that your space allocation is sufficient. And actually, this again, this should be, it allows us to analyze after the fact and perform various operations we might not have initially thought of, is if you've exported it to a file and can examine that file afterwards. Okay. If it's within the simulation, obviously you only get whatever you bargained on to begin with. Okay. On the other hand, if you're sure about what data you want to study, then incorporating the observations into the simulation can sort of reduce the volume of work and the time it takes to gather that data. Okay. So, as we've said, when talking about gathering this output data, this data is based on one run of your simulation model. Therefore, if you do an alternative run of the simulation model with different initial conditions, again, usually the initial conditions being sort of generated by random variables, random variates, then the values you observe are going to be different. So we have one observation of a queue that looks something like this. And that's the output of our simulation model. Run the simulation model again. We'll get some other observation. Okay. And so since the observations are different, the averages, the queue lengths, the percentile values will also be different. Okay. So the question becomes, then, what information can we gather by looking at a single trace? What information can we gather by looking at multiple traces? And the answer is that there's not necessarily a whole lot you can gather by looking at a single trace, even when you go to averages. So if we look at waiting times, well, we have our let's say, 100 events or 100 arrivals followed by 100 departures and gives us 100 waiting times. Those, for any single trace, those waiting times are not independent. If one waiting time is long, that means there's congestion in the system. The next one is likely to be long. Okay. So there's no independence between observations at that level. Although, so then we looked at the average value. But since there's this lack of independence, there's a question of what the average value is saying for us. What you can say is that if you take the average value for the first run and the average value for the second run, and keep running your simulation values, your simulation model over and over again, with different initial conditions, random initial conditions, what you can observe is that then those values that you calculate for each individual run are going to be independent of each other. Okay. So, in order to gather truly independent observations of our system, we're going to have to run the model multiple times. So a single run does not actually tell us what we need to know. Okay. So we run the model a number of times. We gather some sample value for each time, some observed sample value for each time. Then we average over that value, and that average we'll see exactly in what sense, but that average is likely to come close to a system average. Okay, but we need to run a number of independent simulations in order to be able to estimate our system values with any confidence. Okay. And the key concept here will be the confidence interval, which is going to indicate to us how close our estimated values are likely to be to the actual parameters. Okay. So, that's a bit of hand waving. And we're going to do a small bit more now, just discussing a few sort of basic concepts for our system behavior. And typically, for the types of simulations that we're running, we divide our simulation into two periods, an initial or transient phase. And in this initial phase, the observed values are dependent on initial conditions. So, for instance, if you start out with an empty queue, again, that's going to impact on your observation of waiting times. You know, the first guy who gets there, woohoo, he doesn't have to wait long at all. Now, as you go on and on, you reach steady state, and during, again, the steady state period, it doesn't matter where you started. The general characteristics of the behavior of the system are not dependent on initial conditions. Okay. So again, if we have our queue and we started out as empty, well, it's going to remain sort of below the average queue length for a little while until enough arrivals come to sort of populate the queue. But after some point, then you'll will observe that the queue length is going to cycle around the mean. Okay. So at our start, it's always below the mean, but eventually it starts going sort of up and down around the mean. Okay. And so it's possible that this sort of initial phase is of interest in a system. But for our purposes, what we're going to concentrate on is the steady state phase of the system. So a number of questions arise then. How do we determine that we're in steady state? And the answer to that is, well, basically trial and error. You can try runs of various length and compile the steady state compile the statistics for each one. And so eventually, sort of as the lengths get longer and longer, you should see the statistics sort of coming closer and closer to each other. Okay. You can also do this sort of on the fly. And
does it not depend on the system you're...
It does indeed. Yeah.
You might have something you put in, it doesn't matter, it goes off anyway.
Yeah.
So
well,
you have it. I mean, you presume that it's heading towards a steady state.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm saying here is that you actually have to check that's the case.
It might be an unstable system.
No. If a system is unstable, you're never going to reach steady state. In which case, as you sort of try longer and longer runs, the statistics are not going to converge. They're going to keep, well, if you take something like queue length, it should keep going up and up and up and not sort of converge to this average value, because there is no average value. So yeah, you can't necessarily assume that you're going to even reach steady state, but hopefully in testing that you've reached it, you can eventually come to some conclusions about whether you are or not. Okay. And so, yeah, again, this can either be done sort of a stop-start method, or you can try and, if you can compute your values sort of as the system is running, then you can decide that you've reached steady state when your average values stop changing. Okay. And so okay, that's the second point. So the next question then becomes, assuming we reach steady state, what do we do with the transient data? Well, the transient portion of your simulation either needs to be discarded or discounted. And by what I mean by discounted is that you have your transient phase is some length, then obviously if you keep running your simulation for a much greater length, then the contribution of this transient phase is reduced and reduced and reduced for the longer you run your simulation. So either only start collecting the data after you've hit the transient phase, or run it long enough that the transient phase is not making a significant impact on your calculations. Okay. So, what we want to do is to come up with an estimate for an overall system value, such as average waiting time or average queue length. What we've come up with so far is the average waiting time for a single run, or any given run, and the average waiting time for, or the average queue length for any given run, et cetera, et cetera. And so what we are going to do is to use our single samples from each run to produce an overall estimator for the system parameter. Okay, so just to introduce some notation to this, we're going to call our system parameter theta, and the estimator for our system parameter then will be theta hat. Okay. So in order to produce this estimator, what we're going to need is independent observations of our system parameter. And again, this is why it's not sufficient to look at a single trace, because there is a dependent, even if you can get sort of multiple samples out of that trace, there's going to be a dependence between one sample and the next and the next and the next. What we need is independence. Okay. If we can get a number of independent values, then we can average those values to get a system estimator. So the sample value we get from one run is independent of the sample value we get from the next run, is independent of the sample value we get from the next run, assuming we aren't running with the same seed or whatever. And so that will give us our independent samples. We average all those independent samples together to get the overall system estimator. Okay. And so this estimator is itself a random value. It's dependent on, it's a function of these random variables. And so it's not going to be the exact estimator. Depending on what runs we do, our estimator will vary. But what we're going to be able to do is to, in some way, quantify how close our estimator is coming to our actual system parameter. Okay. So generically, suppose we have a number of independent, identically distributed random variables with a mean mu and a variance sigma squared. And for us, what this is going to correspond to is, again, our observations for each single run. Then, and you know, each observation should have is a random variable, but in general you would expect the mean of that random variable to be the system mean, the variance of that random variable to be the system variance. So, you know, again, concretely, if we calculate the average waiting time for each of these runs, then these are a set of random variables. The
Are those independent from IID? What was that again?
Independent, identically distributed.
Why are they independent? Presumably, they've all gone through the same system.
But you started with independent initial conditions when going through that system. So knowing something about how this one behaved, again in the steady state, not at the initial, is not going to tell you anything about how the next one behaves. It's not going to tell you anything about how the next one behaves.
Okay, so the X1, X2 is at the beginning of the system, before you've gone through.
No, X1 is...
Is X1 sort of your average time later at the end of running? Why are they independent? Because they've all gone through the system. I mean, could the system not throw you out constant? Regardless of what you put in, it gives you the same average. Why is it necessarily...
Well...
Your starting conditions are independent. But I'm not sure that your end result is independent after going through
but,
the system.
What the system is going to constrain is the distribution, not the actual value. And that's why it's independent.
That's presuming that the system doesn't lead to, when you say a steady state, that steady state. I mean, the system...
Well, what's going to happen there is that your distribution is not going to... Yeah, so it's not a random distribution. Well, it's a pathological... But what that does is it just gives you a pathological case of a random distribution. Your random distribution is a constant with probability 1.
Yeah,
so it's a pathological case.
It's making an assumption that the system isn't going to throw you out a constant at the start.
No.
It's assuming the system has no input. You're putting in a random sort of initial condition. You have the transient system, in the transient state, and then you have a constant state. That's to say that regardless of what you're putting in, that at the end, at the steady state, that's the same. It depends on what the system is, sure.
Yes, it does.
The presumption that you can only do this on... constraints on the system that you're putting.
I'd have to actually think it through carefully. But what I just, you know, again, what you're going to get there is that your estimator is the actual value always.
I know.
So.
I'm just wondering. I can imagine a system that I put in.
I think we have to think of that as sort of a pathological case. I think what the answer is that everything we say will still hold for it, but there's probably a much simpler answer that you could come up with for such a system, which is just that the answer is X. Yeah. But what we're doing is we're assuming here that there is randomness. And you know, what you have to think of for your system where you always get the one answer is that it's a pathological case of randomness that isn't random. The value is 1, or sorry, the value is x with probability 1. So that's a sort of pathological sort of randomness. You know, you can assign a probability distribution to it, but all of the weight is on a single point. And what we're assuming here is that that's not the sort of systems we have. If it is, then, you know, again, what the conclusion you came up with after running n runs is probably, this is a strange system. I get the same answer out every time. So maybe I should go back and re-examine how random is my system. And the answer might be it's not random at all. But I think the way to think of that is just it's either a special case or a pathological case of what we're going to continue on with now. Okay, so assuming we do have randomness in our system, so the observations we're getting out from each of our runs are slightly different. You hope they're not too different, but you know they're a bit different anyway. Then the sample average estimator is just going to be, well, average over all your runs, average your observation over all your runs. The sample average estimator of the system mean mu. You average it over all the runs. Our first try at a sample average estimator for our variance is going to be, again, just average the values over all the runs. We'll see that that might not be our best option. Okay. Now, our estimator theta hat is a random variable. And so the best we can do to come up with an actual value is to do something like take an expectation. And so one question we might ask is, if we do take the expectation, how close is it to the actual value? And the measure of this is what's called bias or mean bias. Okay. And so the bias is the expectation of our estimator minus the actual parameter, which of course we don't know, but assuming we can say something about it. Okay. And so what we'll see is that our mean estimator, x hat or x bar, is an unbiased estimator of the system mean. Our initial estimate for variance is a biased estimator of variance. And we argue that our second estimator of variance then is an unbiased estimator. Okay. And to see all this, we just have to take the expectations of our estimator and see what we come up with. So if we take the expectation of x hat, we plug in the value for x hat in terms of the average of our observations. Since this is a finite sum, we can pull the expectation inside and calculate the expectation of each of our random variables individually. We already asserted that our random variables were distributed with the system mean, and so that gives us that, the expectation of our system mean estimator is unbiased. Okay, we can try the same thing with our initial estimator of variance. And so again, plug in, take the expectation, plug in the values. If we massage them slightly, we subtract mu off of both quantities, so that gives you a plus minus mu term. So it's just going to make our maths work out nicely. We expand out our square term then and into obviously three terms. Then we can consider each of those three terms individually. And excuse me. By sort of, so this term pulls down. These two terms are equivalent now, and so we have minus 2 and 1 there, so that gives us a minus overall. And so what we see is that the expectation of our variance will always be slightly smaller than our actual variance. Okay. So in this case, they're not equal, so there's a bias in the estimator. And not wanting to labor the point too much, but because of this, frequently alternative estimate for variance is used, which is quite close. It's just instead of 1 over n, we have 1 over n minus 1. And we can observe that this estimate is actually unbiased. Okay, so we plug in our term, we plug in our estimator for s squared, we expand out the terms, we pull the n minus 1 over. Since the values are IID, we can consider each term separately. And we will arrive at this quantity, n e, and the expectation of xi squared over n minus n, the expectation of x bar squared. Okay. So from there, we can just plug in definitions of the variance. So the expectation of xi squared is going to get is sigma squared plus mu squared, because each of these xi's is distributed with mean mu and variance sigma. And similarly for the x bars. Excuse me. And so then finally, using the central limit theorem to say for as estimators for these for our estimate our variance and because our variance and our mu we these are sums of IID random variables, so we can plug in the normal variance and normal mean. Okay. Working out all the terms, then you get that this actually is an unbiased estimate. Okay. So, the upshot of all of this is just to assert that we are going to use our X bar is the average of our observations. We're going to use that as the unbiased estimate of system mean, and we will use the 1 over n minus 1 as the typically as the estimate for the variance. Okay. So, we have our estimates, but again, the exact value of our estimates is dependent on the simulation runs. So, we run n simulations, we get one estimate. We run n different simulations, we get another estimate. Okay. What we would like to hope is that if we run n simulations, that the estimate is in some way close to the actual system estimate, and therefore any batch of n simulations hopefully is close. Okay. What we can do is in some way quantify what we mean by close, and we do this by the use of a confidence interval. Okay. Confidence intervals are always paired with confidence levels, and so a confidence level is a probability expressed as a percentage, something like 95%. Then the confidence interval is an interval centered around our system mean, indicating that our estimated value will fall within that interval 95% of the time. So we have our actual value, and then we're going to have we're going to calculate values. And it's possible that you get very unlucky and for some reason the value you calculate isn't really that close at all to the actual system mean. But what we can do with a confidence interval is to say that, well, most of the time the value you calculate is going to be close to the actual system mean. You can never rule out that you get unlucky. Now, something to work out in your spare time. If we're saying that 95% of the time your estimator will fall in this confidence interval around our actual system mean, then this also means that 95% of the time your system mean is going to fall in an interval of the same width around your observed estimator. So if you can come up with a relatively small interval, then what you're going to say is that most of the time, at least, we can be pretty happy that the actual system value is somewhere quite close to our estimated value. Okay. So, how are we going to come up with this estimate? To come up with this estimate, we are going to make use of the central limit theorem. What the central limit theorem says is that if we have a number of IID random variables, so gee, that's what we said we had for our various runs, the observations from our various runs, then if we compose a random variable as the sum, or 1 over n times the sum of these, then the distribution of this random variable approaches a normal distribution with mean mu and variance 1 over n times the variance of the individual random variables. So now what we've said, at least in the case of our mean estimator, we have this random variable, and if it's composed of, so this was the average estimator. So if our average estimator is composed of sufficient number of observations, then the distribution on this estimator is going to be normal. And furthermore, the more observations we throw into the mix, the smaller the variance is going to be. So the tighter and tighter the values are going to cluster around the mean. Okay. So we're not going to prove the central limit theorem. We're just going to accept it and accept that it gives us this. I throw up a slide here that shows the distribution as you start summing more and more of these variates. So you have, we start with, in this case, a uniform distribution. If you calculate the distribution of two of them, you get this triangle. If you calculate the distribution of four of them, it starts sort of again looking like this bell curve. And the more you calculate 8, 16, 32, the closer you get to the normal bell curve. And as we see also, the tighter and tighter that the values or the density clusters around the mean. Okay. So we're saying that that's the distribution on our random variables, on our estimators. So how do we use this? Well, the disappointing thing about normal distributions is that they're hard to express mathematically. Well, they're easy to express mathematically, but hard to express in a closed form mathematically. The good news is that they're beloved of statisticians, so a lot of study has happened, and you can always, there are tables after tables of values for normal distributions. Typically, what people are interested in is proportions of the population that fall within certain bands around the mean value. Okay. And also typically these are expressed as multiples of the variance. Okay. In these tables. So you don't have to worry about your exact individual distribution. You have a normalized, you have information on the normalized distribution, and then just by sort of adjusting by your specific variance, you get sort of the result for your specific case. Okay. So for instance, say we take our value of 95%. What we would want to, what we're asking is, what interval will capture 95% of your values? And if we see minus 2, between 2 sigma and minus 2 sigma, well, you're excluding about 2% in each case. So if you go, if you have some interval that's just under minus 2 sigma or just over minus 2 sigma and just under 2 sigma, then you'll have caught 95% of your values. So what have we said? Our estimate is a random variable which we have one observation of. We have a distribution for this random variable. So around the actual mean, again, we can produce this interval. Okay. So we can define this interval around the mean. The interval is obviously going to depend on percentage. So 95% we know is sort of here. If you want to go to 99%, you're going to have to spread out your interval. What we also have asserted, and again, it's just think about it, it's got to work, is that that interval, you can also center that interval around your observation and then say that 95% of the time the mean will fall into that interval. Okay. So the procedure, again, is to pick a confidence level. So what percentage of the time do we want to make sure that our estimate and the actual system parameter fall in some interval of each other? And then given that confidence level, so that percentage, then we can produce this, we can produce the interval. So we can say what size that interval has to be. And again, the higher the confidence level, the wider the confidence interval. So that's one side. The other side, again, is that the sigma is going to be shrinking with the number of observations you take. So the more observations you take, the smaller your confidence interval. So the tighter in you can get to the actual estimate, or to the actual value. Okay. So the tables that I mentioned earlier can come in many forms, but what they all have to do is they have to relate the probability, so the percentage, the density, the percentage of the values that we want to catch, to some multiple of our variance, okay, or our value sigma, I should say. So this specific table gives you your densities, and it is doing this from the mean outwards, so from the mean up, so it's giving you half your curve. If you're concerned with both sides, you gotta multiply by two, or in our case, you have to divide our value by two. Okay. So we have our confidence level is 95%, or 0.95 in probability terms. Since we're only dealing with half our curve here, we have to divide that by 2, or 0.475. Okay. We look up that value in the table, and we see that we get a certain multiplier, and in this case, the row entries give the first two digits, and then the ones place and hundredths and tenths place. The column numbers indicate the hundredths place on that multiplier. So in this case, you get 1.96 for your multiple value, which is to say that 95% of all of those values will fall plus or minus 1.96 sigma away from the mean. Okay. So this is a big table of the probability of being between the mean and the mean plus some multiplier of sigma. Okay, so you're in the interval here, say between mu and 2 sigma. Okay. Now, say we wanted to figure out what the probability of being between mu and 2 sigma was. Well, on this table, the column and the rows here are giving you this value 2, so 2.00. So the probability of being between mu and 2 sigma is 0.4772. Okay? So the next question that you might ask is then, what's the probability of being mu minus 2 sigma and mu plus 2 sigma? Answer, it's going to be double that. So 0.9544. anyway, twice 0.4772. Okay, so that's how you read the table. That's what the table means. Now, when we're looking at the table, we're starting out with our probability, and we're trying to find these multipliers of sigma. Okay, so let's take another probability, 90%. If you take the probability 90%, well, what you're saying is that you want 90% to be in some what's the interval that so that 90% of your points are going to fall in that interval around the mean. Okay, so the first thing that we say is, well, when we're looking at this table, we can only look between the mean. So we can only look at half that interval. So half the interval should have half that probability. So 45% or 0.45. Okay.
Presumably that table is based on the number of samples and for sample.
No, this table is just based on, this is the normal distribution. What we've said is we've taken enough samples that it is normal, and the answer is it just approaches that, okay?
So
and as a rule of thumb, around 30 gives you quite a normal distribution. Where were we? 0.45. Okay, so we then say we need to find so what we need is the multipliers of sigma that give us this 0.45. We look at the table, and so it's somewhere between 0.4495 and 0.4505. Yeah, I'll let you decide how you want to deal with that. For now, I'll say, well, close enough to 0.4505. Then we can look at our values. We have 1.6, and then going up, 0.05. So 1.65 would be our multiplier. So what that says is that if our confidence level was 90%, then our confidence interval would have been 1.65 plus or minus 1.65 sigma around the mean. Okay. So work out. I'll post at some point some problems. Just try working on them, and again, come back to me if it's still not clear. Okay, so that says that we can calculate our confidence intervals given a confidence level. Okay, so summing that up to our parameter estimation problem, what we get is that we have our observations with an observation per run. So we come up with an estimate per run. Okay, we use those estimates per run to calculate the overall system estimate or estimator, and if we use enough runs, then this estimator is distributed normal. Once we have this normal distribution, happy days, we can use our tables to find our confidence interval. And, of course, the thing to be aware of is that it is just that And it's what everybody uses, but if your confidence level is 95%, that means that 5% of the time you're going to be wrong, or you're going to be outside this interval. But typically it's about the best you can do. Okay. So, I think I'll take a break now. So try and digest this concept of concept interval. When we come back, we'll talk about a few details, additional complications to dealing with confidence intervals, and then we'll move on. Okay, so let's take about a 15-minute break, and we'll return after that. Oh, come on. Oh, yeah.